On this episode of the Made to Thrive show.
Because we got too much garbage in here. And so it creates this degenerative storage form called a cell. And then it forms this collection of cells in your liver. And then we say that's the liver cancer. And then we make more and more of them because you keep storing garbage. It's like you have a garbage can in your house and you keep putting more and more garbage in. And as long as you can take it out to the curb, you're fine. But next time you put in twice as much garbage and then 10 times as much, pretty soon your whole house is now full of garbage, which explains why surgery, getting rid of the garbage cans, has a certain help, right? Because you got rid of the garbage cans. But it also can't possibly solve the problem, because if you keep adding more garbage, you're just going to make more, you're just going to do the whole thing again.
Hello, Thrive Nation. I have a truly special show for you today with an international health hero, Dr. Tom Cowan. He is a curious observer and a courageous teacher, and spent time as an undergraduate medical student in Swaziland, which greatly influenced his personal life and medical practice. He has written 4 medical books and is seen as an international medical expert in the fields of cardiology, cancer, autoimmune disease, and anthroposophical and herbal medicine. He is a founding board member of the Weston A. Price Foundation, and in 2016, he and his family launched Dr. Cowan's Garden, a company that makes and sells organic vegetable powders to help people diversify their vegetable consumption. We cover the following topics in a robust discussion: why cancer is not a genetic disease and the problem with science, the theory of liver cells and what actually causes cancer, the Gerson diet to clean out the garbage and dissolve tumors, how your belief is the most important field to structure water and its flow, why ATP is not the source of energy, how to stop poisoning ourselves and tips for a healthier lifestyle, what you need to know about mistletoe injections and how to sustain your transformation for continued success and health. Trusting that this episode will inspire and empower you to improve your health, I do need 2 minutes of your time to help the Made to Thrive cause. If you're on Apple, please rate and review the show. And if on Android, please download and share. Head over to www.madetothrive.co.za to subscribe to our newsletter and to engage with more life-changing content. Delight in your purpose and be surrounded. Hello, Thrive Nation. We've got Dr. Tom Cowan on the show today, and he's a curious observer and a courageous teacher. And as my tribe knows, yet Made to Thrive, that teacher comes from that Latin word docere, which means to teach. He's got an incredible website with so much information. I've been listening to him for many, many years. I think he's got now 6 books in place. Incredible book, Human Heart, Cosmic Heart, Cancer, and the New Biology of Water. He's a real hero, and he thinks about things very differently. So welcome to the show, Dr. Tom Cowan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good. Can you give us a little bit of the backstory, how you got into just the way of medicine and the way of thinking? I know you got a rich history with Swaziland, and I think that is a time and place where you engaged Rudolf Steiner and you engaged the Weston Price way and paradigm of doing medicine. So just give us a little bit of history on your sort of education and your background.
So I grew up in a family of father and grandfather were both dentists, actually. And most of their friends were actually doctors, and some fairly prominent doctors, at least in southeastern Michigan. One actually invented the laser that's now, you know, has been used in gynecology for 30, 40 years. And another one had to do with immunology for cancer, and until he got thrown into jail for Medicare fraud. So I grew up in that environment, and I don't know why, but I just was never very impressed, and I didn't really think much of it and just didn't want to be a doctor, even though it was sort of obvious that that's what I should do, but I didn't want any part of it. So I went to undergraduate, didn't like it, finished in 3 years, had no idea what to do. So I was interested in gardening. So I joined the Peace Corps and they sent me to Swaziland and to teach gardening. And I think I may be the only one who can say this in the world. So when I was there, and you know, I had a lot of free time on my hands, living in a hut in Swaziland, in very rural Swaziland. And somebody gave me Weston Price's Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. And a guy who was sort of at the school garden that I before me gave me a book on biodynamics, and Rudolf Steiner, the lectures on the Gospel of St. John. And I mean, I didn't have any other books, so I read them. And it just hit me that the kind of doctor that I didn't want to be was not the only kind of doctor there was. And I didn't know that, you know. I mean, how would I know? And that set off a kind of, it's like a floodgate open. Then for 40 years, basically, I've been interested almost daily in, you know, what is out there and what is reality. And this thing we call Western medicine is by no means the only way of looking at science or medicine. And it's not even a particularly profound way. In fact, it's mostly kind of a ridiculous way. And of course, we don't know that. You know, I went to normal undergraduate, and all I knew was the things I heard didn't make sense. And that's different than knowing what else might make sense. Because if you've never heard that there's any other way to look at it, how would you know? So once I figured out that there was a way of finding this out, then I was off to the races.
Right. So you studied medicine. I think you finished, I think you did 77 to 80. You went Swaziland. And
yeah,
then
I go back to medical school and did, you know, some family practice until basically we decided that I wasn't a good fit for the program because I refused to vaccinate people and do circumcisions. So we had a mutual parting of the ways, and then I set up my own practice and spent the last 35 years trying to figure out how to help people have better lives. It's kind of as simple as that. It's not like there's a lot of magic in it from a certain point of view, but it's not anything more than any person would expect to do. Because the other thing is because I was not affiliated with any hospital or taking HMOs or national health plans. I mean, I did take Medicare, but I was under the situation that if I didn't help people and it wasn't very clear to them that what I was doing was helping them have a better life, I couldn't eat because I couldn't pay my bills. So, and I couldn't do it based on degrees or personality or anything, you know. It wasn't like anybody came to me because I was a convenient doctor. That pressure, I think, was good, because if people didn't get better, and so I couldn't afford nonsense, like theories that didn't work, you know. And so I was in a position, so this is different than most people. Most people can think about like why somebody gets rheumatoid arthritis. But I had 20 people with rheumatoid arthritis. So you can think about it all you want, but I had to help them get better. And that pressure was really helpful for me, because I can't, you know, I couldn't do nonsense.
Yeah. So it was results driven, Dr. Tom. I mean, at the end of the day, you had to get a result. Doesn't matter so much what the science and the research said. I mean, I know that you're research oriented and I know you got very strong views on that, but at the end of the day, you had to do something that worked, that gave a result to your patients, because that's the pressure that you were under. I do want to know from you, I know you say it's sort of maybe coincidence, but you joined the Peace Corps, you love gardening, you start gardening in Swaziland, things start coming to you like a manuscript from William Coley's, and you start getting into that type of medicine. You start reading this this document of I don't know how many cases of people getting better. Was it the nature, just the way you were, or your nurture that you started asking questions? Because other people could have received the Rudolf Steiner book. Everybody could have taken the Western price, but they could have rejected that. They could have said, it doesn't fit my paradigm. I don't think it works. I'm going to go to the traditional route. What was the stimulus for you to start asking continual questions?
So I have a bit of an unusual answer to that. And I don't know if this is accurate or not, but it's my answer, so I'm going to stick with it. I the way I would put it, I was given a tremendous gift from my father as to how to think. And the gift was, as far as I could see, and I could see this very early on in my life, like 3 to 4 to 5 or 7, that this guy knew nothing and he was wrong about everything. And, you know, a child looking up at their father, you would think you would be have a certain respect and certain sense of, you know, but it was very clear to me that I shouldn't do that. And the reason I call it a gift was it essentially taught me. And so here I was with this guy who I'm supposed to look up to, who I didn't, and all his brilliant friends who seemed, I don't know, irrelevant to me. And I didn't like the way they think. And of course, I didn't know any different. But I immediately then thought to myself, these people in authority, they don't know anything. And to me, when I look back, that's sort of the best way to teach somebody. Now, I know that may sound strange to people because they're used to saying, oh yeah, I got this great gift from my parents. They taught me how to do life. So my parents, they didn't, because they didn't know squat. And they were wrong about everything, as far, you know, like most people. And that's another way of giving somebody a real gift, because I was very clear that I had to figure this out for myself, and I couldn't believe anybody who was supposedly an authority, and I had to learn, you know, trust my own sense. So I became what you might call a Gnostic, which means I don't believe anything. Now, of course, everybody believes stuff, right? That's an exaggeration. And I get to the point where I can't know, but it's like, if somebody said to you, how do you know there's a chair under your butt? You know, I mean, it's just, that's just reality. Now, you take that, you know, the native people said they could talk to trees. And then the Europeans would come and they'd say, they'd go up to a tree and listen for 5 minutes and say they don't hear anything. And if I was a native person, I would say, well, what do you think? They speak English? Like, you know, they don't have a larynx. That's, and so talking is the wrong word, right? Mm-hmm. But to say to a native person, a tree doesn't communicate his or her or whatever its experience, is like saying to you, you know, there's no such thing as a chair. Of course there's a chair. And if you don't accept that there's a chair, then you don't accept anything, and you might as well just go off and, you know, whatever, you're like a lunatic. And so I don't want to, you know, it's sometimes not easy to know things, right? But if I say I can communicate with a tree, I want it to be because I can communicate to the tree, and I'm just as sure of that as the fact that I'm sitting on a chair, which I am very sure of.
Do you think the Africans in Swaziland and just your experience here for so many years helped you sort of understand a spiritual and sort of ethereal body and sort of understand that there's more than this physical, you know, body that we, you know, have 5 senses? Did they sort of help you understand a different world?
Well, they certainly helped me understand this concept of reality. You know, if you're a native person and your livelihood is dependent on, you know, seasons and growing food, and if you don't get that together, you can't live. You can't afford to be basing your life on theories about how life should be, and you don't know about it. And same with, you know, native people traditionally, they base their life on their experience and their insight gained from personal knowledge. When they say they speak about the ancestors, they're talking to the ancestors. Now, just because you don't hear it or some Western person doesn't hear it, you know, and they've some famous examples of the Aboriginal people in Australia could have a tribe somewhere out, part of their family, and they were like 20 miles away. And they would find a watering hole that was good. And then they would communicate with these people, you know, their family members 20 miles away, and they would all meet there. And it was obvious that it worked. And the Western anthropologists came and studied it and say, you know, there's no cell phone, there are no smoke signals, there's no nothing. How do you do this? They said, dream time. We go into this space and then we tell the person, turn left at the, you know, fork in the road and whatever. And they said, well, we have to study this. So we're going to do a double blind study and you're not going to know whether you do go into dream time or not. And then we'll see if it works. And people said, yeah, but if we don't know what we're doing yet, it won't work. And they said, you got to try it anyway. So they did it. It didn't work because they didn't know where they were doing it. And then the people concluded that it doesn't work. And that's the kind of nonsense we call science. Or as I like to say, the trouble with science is it's not very scientific. And so they make up rules which guarantee a certain outcome. So like as you say, we start by saying nothing exists but matter, right? That's what a doctor learns. Now, if you ask him, what is matter? Well, it's made of atoms, which are 99.99% space, which means it's made of nothing. So how is that 99% space become a chair that you believe in is the only thing that exists? And they have no answer, which means the whole philosophical framework is a bunch of hooey. And for some reason, they don't get it because they're under a spell.
Okay, well, let's leave that, as we've discussed previously, they're under a spell. And I'm just grateful for your thinking. I followed a lot of your work, read a lot of your books, and you've got incredible videos online on your website. But I know one of your books, Cancer and the New Biology of Water, I want to just dig into, because I know since 1971, Nixon declared the war on cancer. Tell us about the two studies. I think there's a German researcher, the Australian government, what's happened in terms of cancer and the Western medical model, and how you see things from your book that you wrote.
Yeah, and the events of the last 7 months have made me modify what I said in the book a little bit. You know, I like to say that, as you know, in this evolution, we all evolve in our thinking, and as of course have I. And, you know, I've gotten a lot of things, I would say, incorrect, although they're sort of on a pathway, hopefully, to being correct. But I can tell you that every time I made a mistake, every single one was because I believed the dominant narrative too much. And I came to a certain place in the fork in the road, and something didn't make sense to me. And I said, no, I can't prove that, or I just can't think that, because everybody else thinks that. Now, I'm no stranger to thinking things that other people don't think, but I could only be pushed so far. And so what you're talking about is in, you know, 71 or so, they just said they discovered what causes cancer, which is these genetic mutations called oncogenes. So we figured it out. Give us 10 years and unlimited funding, and cancer will be gone. Nobody will die of cancer. That's what they said. Now, so 71, that's like 50 years, if my math is right, 49. And I tried to figure out how much money was spent on this so-called war on cancer. And I originally said $10 trillion, and my editor talked me down to hundreds of billions, because nobody really knows. Because we're talking about cancer research and hospitals and tests and everything. it's the enormous amount of money, like nothing else, like war and cancer research. That's about one and two. So this German guy Ulrich Abel, did a study on all the medical literature published on the benefit. This is in the 90s, so 20 years into it, 10 years after cancer became cured, right? He does a study on the benefit of chemotherapy for advanced cancer, and says that and chemotherapy is the main treatment for, you know, advanced cancer. The benefit, 2.3%, which is basically nothing. Then the Australian government did all kinds of cancer, not just the end stage, and commissioned by the government, 2.1% improvement. This is in the early 2000s. In other words, it's like if you invested in a new kind of toilet paper and invested $20 billion, 20 years later, you got a toilet paper with a picture on it that did nothing better than wipe your butt the same as the old one, you would say, you know, never mind. This is a stupid enterprise. We should do something else. But what we did was double down, and now we keep going and spend more and more billions of dollars. And the problem is the entire theory is incorrect. I likened it to, you know, the example of, you know, you come across a guy and there's a street light and he's looking for something. And the guy, you come up to him and say, what are you looking for? He says, my keys. So you help him look for a minute. And then you say after a while, so where'd you lose your keys? He said, over there in the bushes. So why are you looking here? And he says, because the light's better. And you can look in the genes all you want, but the issue of cancer has nothing to do with the genes, so you're not going to find it. And then you can't make anybody better, and then you end up doing a lot of things that make no sense.
So it's not a genetic sort of disease. It's in the cytoplasm and the mitochondria are in the cytoplasm. So just tell us about the new biology of water. I don't know your changes over the last 7 months, but in your view, and I know understanding it's a journey and there's no foolproof, if you had the cure to cancer, then, you know, I think it would be, you know, it would be out there. But along your journey, in your own words, you know, understanding this new biology of water, what causes cancer?
All right. If you can play along with me for a minute, I'd like to turn this around and ask you a series of questions because I think it'll help us understand. Is that okay?
That's fine. That's good.
Okay, because this is the part that I got mostly correct, but the difference with what I'm going to say now makes it even clearer to me. And then you get a very clear picture of what cancer is. So in order to understand human being, just like understanding anything, if I asked you, what is this calculator made out of? You would say, whatever, buttons and something. So let's just do a human being, right? Because that's what we're talking about. So what is a human being made out of?
Tissues, different type of tissues.
Okay, a soul, let's think we're just about 6 to 7 years old. So let's try that question again. What is a human being made out of? Now, again, we're Gnostics here. We don't believe anything. We just believe what we see.
I'm going to go for structure. It's got presence. Maybe it's a physical, emotional, mental, spiritual being, but it's got a form. It's got a structure that you can see.
I don't mean to be offensive, but we need to send you to the school for the rehabilitation of the overeducated.
I like your humor. I like this engagement.
Okay, let's try again, or I'll help you out. Do you agree that a human being has a head and an eyes and a nose and arms, legs, a chest and toenails and hair?
Yes.
I don't have much hair.
It has a body.
Right, and a body has all those parts.
Correct.
You agree?
I do.
How sure are you that human beings have heads?
Very sure.
Right. I don't think you're quite as sure that human beings are made of soul and spirit. I mean, it could be correct, but let's just say not everybody would agree with that.
Correct. I agree with you. I'm just a very spiritual and sort of soulish person. I try and spend more of my time in the spiritual and the emotional sort of spheres and worlds than in the physical world.
Okay, but I'm going to bring you down into the physical world here, okay?
Sure.
So we agree that you're made of all these different body parts, right? And I think most people, if not everybody, would agree to that.
Sure.
Now, let's go deeper. What's inside that?
Blood, bones, muscles, what else?
A tongue,
organs, yeah.
Liver, kidneys, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Now, here's the interesting thing. If you go through the history of humanity, how many different indigenous people, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, Native American, agreed that human beings are made of heads and parts and feet and toenails and the rest of it? 100%, right?
Yeah, all of them.
All of them. How many of them do you think thought the human being was made of organs like liver and kidneys and heart and blood and stuff like that?
I don't know, none of them.
All of them. The Chinese medicine is based on the flow through your liver is no good.
Yeah, but they didn't dissect them. They didn't open them up and have sort of the exact same, I suppose, you know, analogy of what those organs looked like and what they felt like and what they...
Yeah, but they were pretty darn close.
Okay.
They knew you had a heart. And they knew, and they could see it, because sometimes, you know, somebody would have a bullet wound or a bayonet or something, and you see the heart.
Yeah, then you've got a point.
And I think they were 100% sure, and they all said, they all based their medical system on flow through the organs and blood and stuff that they could see. So... personally, I agree that we're made out of blood and heart and liver. And by the way, you can see them on an x-ray. You can see them on an ultrasound. You can see them on a CT scan, right? Okay,
absolutely.
Let's go deeper. Let's take a liver, for example. What is a liver made out of?
Different parts, different lobes, different tissues, different cells. So.
Yeah, different... lobes, but it's made of the same tissue.
Yeah.
But a liver is made of cells, right? And a heart is made of heart cells, and a muscle is made of muscle cells, and nerves are made of nerve cells, right?
Right.
Now, how do you know that?
I don't know, because you can see it, I suppose, because I went to medical school and I put it on the microscope and I saw it and I've seen it.
Right. Now, here's an interesting question. Did you see, go back to the liver for a minute. Did you see the liver cells while it was in the liver?
No, only on dissection, but that person was, for a whole year, I saw a lot, but not while they were living at all.
Right. You have to take it out of the liver, and then you have to cut it up, and then you have to poison it, otherwise called staining it.
Yeah.
Then you look at it under a microscope, and you see that you see liver cells. Now, here's the interesting thing, because Goethe originally said this, the trouble with Western science is they want to study frogs, like they want to help frogs and make frogs have better lives. So what's the first thing we do? We kill the frog, and then we study it and see what it's made out of. You know how many Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, Native American medicine said that we're made of cells? None.
Zero, yeah.
Now, it could be they were wrong and they couldn't see it because they didn't have a microscope. But actually, the idea that we're made of cells started in about 1850 with a guy named Rudolf Virchow. He was the father of cellular pathology. And what's interesting about it is everybody thought at the time he was a lunatic, because they said that the tissue, which is real, which is what it looks like on an ultrasound, on a CT scan, on an MRI, it's what it looks like when you feel it. Well, it's what it feels like if you, a surgeon, you put your hand in a liver, in an abdomen, you feel a homogeneous liver. And just like bacteria, when you threaten them, they form spore forms. which is their storage form. So the idea that we're made of cells has never actually been proven in a living system. He actually got this because he said onions are made of cells, which I think they are. Therefore, humans must be. I mean, maybe, but yeah. I'm not sure I think that's sound reasoning. Now, if that's true, then what is a liver made of? A liver is made of organized water. And it's organized by the proteins and the nucleic acids and the DNA and the RNA and the lipids. And it's got embedded in that mitochondria and ribosomes and all these things. It's like Jell-O. And if you think about it, and if, you know, if I were God, which I'm not, and they say, which is the better way of forming a liver? To break it up into millions of pieces and have to have these pieces communicate, or just have, you know, what you refer to easy water or gelatinous water, or the best way is that it's a coherent structure, which is, you know, based on fractals, and each tissue, depending on what it's supposed to do, is organized differently to create its function. So the lens of the eye is made by proteins and minerals and nucleic acids and energies and all this to be transparent to light. There are no cells in a lens. It's just a flexible water crystal that bends and moves, and the purpose of it is to transmit light so you can see. The purpose of a liver is different. So there you have to use colored proteins and colored substances so it looks red, and it organizes itself into a living tissue.
So the structure defines the function. The structure, the morphological 3D structure, is more important than the cells themselves.
There are no cells. The cells only are an artifact of removing it as a protective form.
Okay. Wow. This is a bit of a...
Right? You take out the... You have no proof, I can tell you, that there are liver cells in you right now. Right? Have you ever seen them?
No, you're right.
You can't... So it's a theory. And the only evidence you have is if you remove it from you and then poison it and cut it up into pieces, then it forms these forms. Now, there is one exception, that the body forms cells inside you when you're living. And that's the process called cancer. So how does that come about? Okay, let's say you have this liver and it's homogeneous, coherent, structured water, which is the best information acceptor. It's like a radio that's tuned to everything that a liver needs to do. Every electromagnetic frequency, every emotion, every spiritual, it's, you know, they used to say it's tuned into Jupiter, plus it's tuned into food and glyphosate, and it's doing its job. You don't need to break it up into a million pieces. And then suddenly you come along and you poison the crap out of it. Or you cut off the Jupiter, or you have negative emotions, or whatever you think is negative. And so now you have this stuff that doesn't belong in dissolved in the gel. It's like a poison grape in your Jell-O. Now, you have one, and you can dissolve it and get rid of it. But if you still have 100, and then 1,000, and then 1,000,000, the body says, we better put this in a storage garbage can and hope that somehow this schmo figures out how to get rid of it. Gotcha. Because we got too much garbage in here. And so it creates this degenerative storage form called a cell. And then it forms this collection of cells in your liver. And then we say that's the liver cancer. And then we make more and more of them because you keep storing garbage. It's like, you have a garbage can in your house, And it's, you keep putting more and more garbage in, and as long as you can take it out to the curb, you're fine. But next time you put in twice as much garbage and then 10 times as much, pretty soon your whole house is now full of garbage, which explains why surgery, getting rid of the garbage cans, has a certain help, right? Because you got rid of the garbage cans. But it also can't possibly solve the problem, because if you keep adding more garbage, you're just going to make more, you're just going to do the whole thing again. And what is a metastasis is, used to store all the garbage in the garage, and then the garage is now full of garbage. You can't put any more garbage cans, so you put it in your kitchen, and then you put it in the bedroom. And next thing you know, you can't live in your house, and then you go find a new house, and we call that dying. So if that's true, which, it, you know, makes sense to me, it makes sense, because if you go to the therapies that work, like what is the Gerson diet? It's very simple. Clean out your garbage. And if you clean out your garbage, then you can actually dissolve that tumor, because here's the key. That tumor is your body's healing attempt. These things we call diseases are better referred to as strategies. The body, it's like, what would you do if you had that much garbage? You'd buy garbage cans, unless you just want to throw it in your house, and you don't want to do that, so you buy garbage cans as a therapeutic step. Unfortunately, the medical system and doctors are completely confused between this strategy the body uses versus a quote disease caused by, and of course, you see disordered genetic material in there, right? Because everything is disordered. In fact, turns out the genes are embedded in structured water. And the structured water determines the three-dimensional shape of the genes. And I have research that absolutely confirms that 100%. So even the expression of the genes is because of it's embedded in this coherent water, which then, by the way, means there's no such thing as a genetic disease. Because it turns out we have every piece of genetic material in the universe in us. How do I know that? I mean, Kerry Mullis first said that. He was the guy who invented the PCR test. He said, if you look hard enough, and you combine that with the work of another Nobel Prize person named Barbara McClintock, who showed that the genes are malleable. In other words, they're not fixed entities. Your water can change the gene to make what it wants. So if the reality is you have every piece of genetic material and you can change them based on the water, which is the carrier of your consciousness and the emotions and these spiritual things that you're talking about, that's the interplay. Thoughts, feelings, work through water, change the genes, make an effect. If that's true, then you don't have, you or anybody doesn't have a genetic disease. They have an expression malfunction. In other words, their thoughts are wrong, or that's maybe not the right way to say it. Their thoughts creating a certain outcome, which we call disease, that influences the water, which changes the expression. And to blame that on the expression is philosophically, you know, it's like kindergarten. Anyways.
That was great. And there's a lot there. I think you're blowing my mind a bit, just that we're not made of cells. But I think, you know, I think these are important concepts that you've been thinking about. And I think my sort of Western medicine sort of brain and just my logical thinking sometimes what just deters me from starting to really come to grips with these, you know, these new concepts, should I say. Just the fact of Gerald Pollack's work of, you know, easy water and structured water and the fourth phase of water, just reading that was part of the journey. And I think you said some important things that it is a bit of a journey. The question I want to ask you, this easy water or this cytoplasm that's so important that basically works on epigenetic factors, or, you know, gene expression. What are the big influences?
This way, we wouldn't even talk about cytoplasm, because I don't think even there, I'm not sure about this, because there may be nuclei embedded in this tissue that's water, that's incorrectly. Cytoplasm means that there's a nucleus and a cytoplasm and a cell. If there's just tissue which is structured water, then it's likely that it's all cytoplasm. And the nucleic acids are just floating around freely in the tissue and only coalesce under certain situations.
Wow.
Now, interestingly, some people say, no, that's wrong. I can see red blood cells in living blood, right? That's one of the arguments I get against this. But if you think, what is a cell? It's a cell membrane, it's cytoplasm, nucleus, right? Red blood cell doesn't have a nucleus. That is not a cell. That's an oxygen delivery device. But it's round, right? So I'm not saying you can't have round devices or specialized tissue. That is a specialized tissue. A sperm is a specialized nucleic acid delivery device. There's no cytoplasm. It's not a cell. An egg is a cell, but that's the one exception, because nature said, okay, we got a storage form here. Let's protect the species.
So it's almost the different organs are just different flows of water, or different fields, or different biomagnetic
fields. Energy fields collect different proteins to make the scaffold, right? I want this nucleic acid to make this protein in the muscle. In fact, Pollock has demonstrated that muscles work by water phase changes. There's no actin myosin thing. That's nonsense. And think about it, which would be a better design flaw or design? A organized gelatinous structure that's coherent the whole length of your leg, versus tiny little pieces all broken up that have to communicate somehow in coordination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
I got you. That actually makes sense in terms of, you know, I played a lot of rugby in my career and a lot of physical sports. If these were little pieces or these little cells, then if there wasn't a flow or fluid, how could you take all these forces? What would happen to all these forces? I mean, you would take one force, boom, it would break. But because it's the structure, this flow, it's able to dissipate the forces. You know?
Right. And so imagine a really thick water balloon, right? Not a thin one. So you have this thick water balloon, which has a thick membrane around it, right? So I'm not saying it doesn't have the tissue, the liver may have a capsule, which it does. And then you could bang into that and it would just respond and it would sense the forces. It would sense what's happening from the outside. Mm. It's an amazing design.
Yeah.
Except we missed it because we have it all broken up into pieces. And what the benefit of that for cancer is, if it makes sense, you can see all these different therapies. The Gerson therapy, you know, mistletoe was supposedly to fix your water body. Well, there you go. And fever therapy makes the gels run, so you reconstitute a better gel. You dissolve it, let it run. That's called mucus. And then you reconstitute a gel. And it even makes sense in 1899, in the Merck manual, it says you can cure cataracts with turpentine. So what does that mean? So cataracts is, you got this crystalline tissue and you got stuff dissolved in it, which shouldn't be there. So it's making it cloudy, so you can't see. So you use a solvent, which is turpentine, and that dissolves the shit in the gel, and now you got a clear gel, and then you can see again. Like, what's so complicated about that? And if you got a certain tissue like a nose, and you got this stuff dissolved in your gel, the bacteria come to help you out and they eat it. and then they make mucus, and then you think you have an infection, but what you really have is the bacteria biodegrading the stuff in your tissue to clean it up, just like they do in the forest.
Mm. I think this is incredible. It sort of reminds me a lot of my previous work about, you know, you go and sprain your ankle and then you've got this massive, you can just see this huge hematoma that develops. And we think it's clever by taking anti-inflammatories and putting ice on. But the body's put all that fluid there to do something, to bring healing and to have all the growth factors. And we think the inflammation's bad, but that's the body's natural response to bring healing.
Right, and to immobilize the joint so you don't walk on it for a few days.
Correct.
And you can demonstrate. So this is what I mean by I had to be effective. So if somebody came in with a big swollen joint, I had to say that's because their water structure is disintegrating and the body is trying to immobilize it. So if I could figure out how you structure water properly, which is a combination of certain proteins and exposure to the earth and the sunlight and, you know, good thoughts, whatever, then we would structure their bursa better, which is an organized liquid, and then the body wouldn't try to dissolve it anymore.
Gotcha.
And then in the upshot of that is they no longer had rheumatoid arthritis. Thank you very much. And then I get 10 more people with rheumatoid arthritis. And I'm not saying, you know, like everybody gets cured because life is tough and you can't necessarily reorganize everybody. But in theory, you can. And that's the goal. And it's only when you create a rational system of medicine, unlike the irrational system, which keeps blaming the wrong things for the problem. Then I used to tell people, go to your rheumatologist, ask him how many people he's cured with his drugs for rheumatoid arthritis. You know what the answer is? Exactly zero. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you say that to them, they get pissed at you to say, how dare you ask me that question? I mean, it seems like a perfectly reasonable question to me. Like, how many people actually are, does this solve their problem? In fact, institutionally, we say our medicines don't solve the problem. You have high blood pressure, you take drugs for the rest of your life. If you say, can I do something so I don't have high blood pressure? They say you're a lunatic.
Yeah, I got you. Well, I want to run through, I've got a little 4-year-old daughter, I've got a 16-year-old son, and you know, a bit of Chinese medicine background that I've had. I haven't missed a day's work in 22 years, haven't had Western medicine in 23 years. Run over 35,000 kilometers and many comrades marathons that you might have heard about. But with my 4-year-old, this is what I'm starting with. And I'd love you all, because I want to do talk about those things that help the water, you know, help this structured, easy water and this flow. And I've started with her and her belief systems, because your belief carries so much, such a great field. It's so powerful what you believe. And obviously your beliefs can be affected by thoughts and circumstances and people. But to start with an understanding of belief being probably the most powerful field that can structure this water and help this flow. And I don't know what you think about that. And obviously there's sunlight and being outside. And I think Weston Price, we focus on the diet, but most of these people that he looked at in terms of their teeth and their dentition, they were outside. They were in the sun. They were grounded. You know, they had sunlight hitting their testicles and their gonads, and they had, you know, they were exposed to dirt and they just, so I think it was far more important than the diet that people say from a Western price. But help me along. What do you think about belief being probably the most important field? And then what else do you think I should do regarding my 4-year-old as I bring her up in this very sort of physical world?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's the most important, but I mostly agree, because I think the way we think, I would put it what we know rather than what we believe. And there's some quote about it's what gives you the most trouble is what you know to be true. It's not what you, I don't remember the quote, but what you think is true or what you believe to be true unconditionally, that just ain't so. That's what gets us. So it boils down to help a human being understand that they're the co-creator of their life. Now, I would say they're the co-creator with something bigger than us, like the divine. That's what I would say. You could agree with that or not, but that's been my sort of experience. And so that means we're not victims of anything. And if you believe in the germ theory or the genetic thing or any of the, you are a victim of forces and circumstances which you have no control over. Now, I'm not saying that if somebody puts a 5G tower or puts a glyphosate factory on your front lawn, that that's a good thing. And you could probably believe whatever you want, and it may not be good enough. So there are, I don't like to be exclusive, like it's all belief.
Yeah.
Because I don't think if you believe anything, if you poison somebody with strychnine, it's probably not going to go well. So I believe in poisons and food. And the thing is, we don't have to just say it's all this.
Yeah, gotcha.
It's food, it's sunlight on your testicles, it's earthing, it's moving your body, it's how you think and how you feel and what you know and what you don't know and what you think you know that just ain't so. All those things. Why does it have to be just one?
No, it never is. It's just multifactorial in such a complex way. And I think we're still asking questions, never mind community, how important people are. You know, I had James Maskell on the show. How important those community, those people coming together, sharing their fields, sharing their heart fields, coming together in a network of unity, but diversity. That's how the body works, is multiple fields from these organs, but they're working in unity. And that's why they bring coherence and function and all those things. So never
mind. That's why people who don't wish us well, their first step is to divide and conquer.
Yeah.
And wear masks and keep 6 feet apart, which is a sort of esoteric symbol in itself.
Absolutely.
And then you disconnect people from the source of life, and then they're floundering. And that's where we are now. And so it's either going to be a coherent reunion or it's not going well.
Yeah. But I do think people are rising up, you know, yourself. I've listened to a lot of Kelly Brogan. You know, there's a few people that are saying, you know, we're going to get together, the James Maskells of the world, to say, hang on. You know, I do think there's a rise, there's a spiritual awakening, because I think the light from a spiritual aspect that brings us illumination and sort of brings us revelation is the most important. And I've got hope, I've got hope when I listen to you speak, and I've got hope when people are saying, hang on, actually, we're going to do this thing very differently and come together as a community and stand up together.
Yeah, well, let's see what happens, because that's what we're driving for.
Brilliant. I do want to just quickly unpack Gilbert Ling and charges and how important that is from, let's not call them cells, but let's call them flow, because you've thrown me a little bit of a curveball, because I've never thought about this thing. There's no cells and it's no cytoplasm, and maybe it's more just flow with a, you know, overall, like the liver, just the structure surrounding it like a cap. And I'm really trying to process that, which is fine. We're all on a journey, you know. At the end of the day, I think you're in the place that you're at because you kept on asking questions and kept on being teachable, you know. So I think that's incredible. But tell me about charge, Gilbert Ling, and, you know, just how important structure is in terms of our, you know, our bodies.
I mean, Gilbert Ling, his two most important contributions for me were, you know, he more or less thought about cells, and he said there is no sodium-potassium pump. That's a myth. And he proved that with arithmetic, basically. And because if you actually run the numbers on how much energy is used in the pump, it's about 30 times more than the cells, he would say, have to do everything. And so the charge, which is Western science says the charge across the cell membrane comes because of the sodium-potassium pump, and he said it's nonsense. It's because the cytoplasm is structured water, and it's so sized to naturally exclude sodium and hang on to potassium. Now, the other big thing, which is, I think, even bigger, because every alternative medicine doctor in the world that I know of practically gets this wrong, which is they say ATP is the source of energy. And that's just nonsense. And he proved that ATP has no more energy than any other molecule. But what ATP does is it attaches to the proteins, and so it unfolds them. In other words, if you make Jell-O, you start with proteins like this and water, and nothing happens. So you heat it, and that unfolds the proteins, and they interact with water to form a gel when it cools. And in the cell or the tissue, it's the same. You have folded proteins. The ATP attaches to the end, unfolds it, and structures the water. So without ATP, there's no structured water and there's no energy. So it fools you into thinking the ATP created the energy, but it didn't. It just attached to the protein. That creates the energy, and that's the currency of life, so to speak, is the charge and the electromagnetic field that comes from the unique abilities of water to create a charge.
Incredible. Does that mean sometimes sunlight can do that without ATP because it heats up that, you know, that protein and it heats up that structure and then it cools down? So we actually don't really need, we just need sunlight, a wave, a frequency that can do that. So tell me, other than belief, if we got sunlight, the importance of sunlight, the importance of earthing, the importance of possibly infrared light, which is a sort of a big biohack these days, what are the important things that, you know, heat up this Jell-O and then cool it down?
Well, you only want to heat up your gel if you have stuff in there to get rid of.
We've always got stuff, don't we, Dr. Tom? Yeah, I mean, and that stuff's getting more and more, you know. So at the end of the day, if I look at what I have to do now to keep, you know, what I think is healthy, it's every single year I've got to do more and more. You know, I've got to earth more, I've got to get more sunlight, I've got to get better air, I've got to get better DD. You know, we're looking at deuterium depleted water. We haven't spoken about that, which I want to touch on. But I mean, it's just every year it gets more and more and more.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of things, you know, and I outline a lot of them in the new book. One of my favorites is, you know, every day I do about a 20-minute or so. It's not an infrared sauna. It's an incandescent red light sauna. And so then you're basically, you know, using that heat in these sort of almost like sunlight waves to create heat, and you sweat out buckets, and then you drink a lot of good water. And that's one strategy. And
good. Can I stop you there? That the sauna space, the incandescent bulb, I use the same. I've got on my desk. I use it 5 times a week at home. I got my family in there.
Yeah. So we have one with the Faraday cage and all that. I mean, I have all kinds of devices and stuff, you know. But I don't know that everybody has to go out and do that. I mean, I do it because that's my gig, you know. But I mean, we soak in oxygen tubs and you know, all that stuff. But it's really, I mean, we have a social cultural problem, which was basically we're poisoning the crap out of ourselves. And as you say, it's getting worse and worse. Ultimately, we just have to stop, because that's the only solution there is. Whether we will, who knows? We'll see.
But Dr. Tom, what do we do in the interim? You know, I'm thinking of possibly moving down to the coast so that I can swim in the sea. You know, that's very good for grounding, spend more time on the beach, spend more time with my friends, try and just, you know, escape to a certain degree, you know, do what I can to inspire and educate like you're doing. What are we doing in the interim other than just stop? I mean, I've got a 4-year-old, I look her in the eyes and I think, you know, I just, what am I going to do that she can just, you know, add value to the world and live a, you know, a great, healthy life with her friends and family?
I mean, that's a good start right there. Grow your own food and get, you know, use biogeometry to help mitigate EMF toxicity, which is getting worse, and grounding and swimming in the ocean. And I mean, I don't think you need me to tell you what to do.
What about mistletoe injections preventatively to try and get, you know, I heard something so fascinating that you said, which was incredible, about, you know, the heat that your body generates let's call it a bacteria for want of a better word, because my mind's spinning, but let's call it about colis. You get this, your body then, the fever's there to deal with whatever it's dealing with, if we want to call it a pathogen. But what about injecting mistletoe as sort of a preventative, or maybe getting an infection twice a year, trying to sort of institute an infection so your body generates its own heat to deal with anything?
I don't think you should go out of your way to make yourself sick. I mean, it'll happen if you need it to happen. It's more important what you do with it if you happen to get it. Now, whether everybody should go out and do a course or two of mistletoe when, you know, I know some people who would say in your 40s, you should do, you know, two or three series of seven injections of mistletoe. I mean, I haven't done that. I have nothing against doing that, but I don't see doing that right now.
Gotcha.
I mean, I don't like go out of my way to get myself sick. I'd rather do the saunas and eat right and grounding and garden and, you know, drink the best water and, you know, see if that works.
Great. Last topic. I know we're coming to the end of the show. DDW, deuterium depleted water. How important is that? You can't really find it in South Africa here. I'm looking to import it. Maybe I'm going to speak to Laszlo Boris or, you know, try and get in here for not only cancer patients, but to prevent a lot of disease. You know, there's just so much, you know, information on structured water, on, you know, minerals in your water. And what's your sort of take on DDW, drinking it preventatively?
I mean, I think there's some really good evidence that if you get your tissue deuterium level under 130, the way I see it is deuterium is basically a toxin. So it interferes with the ability of the water to form the proper bond angles because it's the wrong molecule. So if you get rid of it, especially if you have some serious disease or cancer, you have improved outcome. Now, I don't know that everybody needs to do that. There's, you know, some problems with all the formulations, like it comes in plastic bottles, which I don't like. So I don't like drinking water in plastic bottles. I just don't do that. So there's one company that makes 5 parts per million in glass bottles. It's extraordinarily expensive. So, you know, if I had cancer, I'd probably get my deuterium level checked, see if it's 130. If it isn't, I would drink enough deuterium water to get it under 130 and sort of check it every once in a while to make sure it's there. Because it's pretty clear people who do that have better outcomes.
Right. All right, last question for you, Dr. Tom. I thank you so much. I'm definitely going to contact you. Hopefully we can look at the mentorship program. I think you've got got an incredible mind. I want to tap into your years and years of experience. So hopefully we can do that in the future. But I see so many people even adapt let's call it a nutritious diet or an outdoor lifestyle or getting into the sun or whatever it is that has really helped them, you know, feel better, feel healthier, but they don't maintain it. So what do you think some key, you know, pieces of advice or key takeaways that can help people sustain their transformation? Because it's been my biggest challenge. You know, you see someone, you've treated them, you've helped them 3 years later, they're back on your doorstep or they're back at the practice with something else. They've stopped all these healthy habits and they've gone back into their old ways. Now, what are some key drivers to help people maintain their change?
You know, when I think about that for myself, I think of it like this. If somebody said to me, you know, because I've been eating more or less this way for almost 40 years. And of course, as a result, you have all your systems in place to get the food and cook the food. And, you know, I cook it on clay donabis and, you know, the whole thing. My whole life is around these kind of things. So if somebody said to me tomorrow, you know, Tom, it's really better if you had cornflakes and pasteurized skim milk for breakfast and, you know, fake burgers for dinner. I would have to say, so where do you get this kind of stuff? And they say, well, you go to the grocery store. I said, I don't know where the grocery store is. Like I've never been in a Safeway for decades. I'm sure I could figure out how to open a box of cornflakes, but I have no experience with that. Mm. My point is, once you create a habit and a life where it's easier for me to eat biodynamic vegetables and bone broth, because that's what I do when I wake up. You know, I just do it and it's all there and I have the system for growing it and getting it. And it becomes easy and it becomes, anyways, I like that food. And so I'd have to say, I don't really like cornflakes and pasteurized. It doesn't taste good. You know, like I don't really want to eat this. And once you're there, you're home free.
Yeah.
Because then it's a pain in the ass to not go for a walk.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's, you know, that's what you do and your friend comes over and you go swimming. And to not do that, you'd have to call them up, say, I don't want to go swimming today, you know. And see, you might as well just go. Mm-hmm. And that's how I see it. You just build habits. Once you do that, doing anything but that becomes more trouble than it's worth.
Okay.
And then you're good.
Great. Well, Dr. Tom Cowan, I think a true health pioneer, incredible mind, been blowing my mind here now without any cells in the body, just thinking about that and just the flow of this incredible water in our bodies. I just want to thank you. I want to just declare blessing and favor over you that you would carry on in good health and carry on challenging the paradigms, carry along the journey. Just grateful for your work. It's been impactful in my life. And yeah, I want to wish you well. And hopefully we can do some further conversations in the future.
Okay.
I'm still trying to get in your amazing vegetable powders, but I'm sure that'll come in the future. But thank you so much. Take care.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll chat soon. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Made to Thrive show. New episodes are released weekly and are published exclusively on the Made to Thrive podcast link. If you're interested in receiving more thriving insights, as well as receiving other exclusive member benefits, visit madetothrive.co.za/subscribe. This podcast is for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of healthcare professionals for any such conditions.